Drama podcast. More a pungent disaster than a dungeon master, I'm Scott. Later, I'll be joined by everyone's favorite Jedi master. Wait, that's the wrong show. Let's go with that D&D thing. Let me see. Will called himself Will the Wise a few seasons back, so later we'll be joined by Brian the Benign. No, wait. Brian the Banal. Or is that Banal? No, it's Banal. Banal. Brian the Brusque? No, whatever. You know what? Brian will be joining a little later. I'll just intro him then. Yeah. It's not very common for me to break format like that, but stranger things have happened. And that's why we're here tonight to talk about Season 4, Part 1 of Stranger Things. Now, if I were to assemble a top 10 STVD podcasts, that's Serious TV Drama for the uninitiated out there, which would be culling through all 345 of them, I do believe the one that covered the first season of Stranger Things would definitely make the cut for, you know, that top 10 I just mentioned. That would be episode number 133 from way back in July of 2016. Actually, that was quite the summer. We were doing a lot of very eclectic podcasts back then. I mean, the audio quality might not have been the greatest. I think I just started using that Radio Shack microphone at that point. But the content at the time more than made up for it. I mean, we were covering everything that summer. Game of Thrones, Preacher, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Peaky Blinders. And even later that summer, I did the infamous Let's Get Drunk and Watch Gotham podcast. But it was the Stranger Things one. That one was just, you know, scrupulously researched and put together, oh, so carefully. And I co-hosted that with one of our frequent guest podcasters so many years ago, and that was Cade Edwards. I wasn't really a big fan of the second season, and that could be why we didn't cover the second season. And then Cade was taken from us far too soon between the second and third season. It was kind of a shock, for me at least. So as a result, it really felt wrong for me to ever podcast about the third season when that was released, despite how much of an improvement I did feel it was over season two. But, you know, I think hopefully with Kate's blessing, I think enough time has passed to take a stab at Stranger Things once again. Now, from its inception, Stranger Things was always a hybrid of Stephen King and Steven Spielberg, you know, with a little dash of John Carpenter sprinkled into the mix. You take that concoction, then you steep it deeply, oh so deeply, in 80s nostalgia, and there's Stranger Things for you. But what I greatly appreciated more about Season 4 of Stranger Things, probably far more so than the previous three seasons, was that, yes, there is still a slew of 80s references and Easter eggs and whatnot, and hey, maybe we'll mention a few later on. You know, maybe we'll just leave it to y'all to track down the multitude of BuzzFeed-like articles that list all the many references. That's not what we're here for. But back to the season, it felt far less reliant on such nostalgia. I mean, not to be cliche here, but it truly felt more about plot and character than it ever had before. Now, are there plot holes and logic gaps in this season? Sure. One could never claim the writing of Stranger Things is airtight. It never has been. But the ride is pretty tense and definitely fun-filled enough to overlook most errors and mistakes and so on. And even some of the ones that have been tackled in the press by the show's creators, for example, like Eleven being just a little more chatty during her time as a much younger child under Brenner's care than we remember from all those season one flashbacks. Huh, you know what? Whether you buy their explanation that the practically mute or few word using Eleven, that was more of the post-massacre Eleven than what we were seeing during this season, whether we believe it or not, it doesn't matter. I actually was more impressed by the digital wizardry of cutting Millie Bobby Brown's age in half in many of those scenes from her current age of 18 to 9. Now, Speaking of such scenes, let's dive into that opening of the series, as it does set the bar for the dark and even violent nature of how the rest of the season unfolds. The opening, and perhaps it should be noted that we get a warning that this episode was filmed a ways back, as the timing of the recent school shooting and what takes place at Hawkins Labs here is rather unfortunate. Now, I will confess, I did not realize that this opening that we were watching was actually a misdirect, a mystery even, until far later in the season. I initially took it as a, wow, they're really going super dark with this new season, and I like it. Eleven has a lot of blood on her hands, and not just literally. But it has a chilling effect. It's there to inform us. You know, you think you know Eleven's backstory, or at least enough of it. Well, you don't. And if you're questioning that, what else might you be questioning? But, you know what, let me pivot away from that opening now, and give an overall view of all the storylines of Season 4, which can essentially be broken down pretty much like this. Well, number one, you have the rise of the creature that the kids name Vecna. Once again, they're lifting a name out of Dungeons & Dragons. It's basically a much more evil version of Big Mouth's Shame Wizard that leaves its victims as broken, mangled, and distended corpses. Now, this town of Hawkins is gripped in fear and paranoia, though you'd think they'd be used to such things by now. And a number of Hawkins residents we know and, well, even if love's a bit strong, let's say really, really like, whether they're freaks or geeks or neither, they all set out to hunt down, as well as save one of their own, Max, and clear the name of a new addiction to the mix, Eddie, who kind of looks like a genetic fusion of Eddie Van Halen and Robert Downey Jr. We'll have more about him in a minute. It's a storyline with character subplots intertwined like Vecna's viney tentacles. You know, will Steve and Nancy get back together? Will Robin feel bold enough to tell anyone other than Steve about her actual sexuality? What about Lucas and Max? And does Max have extra batteries for that Walkman of hers? Then we can bounce over to, you know, what I would say is number two, the West Coast, where the Byers family was relocated along with Eleven. Now, the focus there splits like the Demogorgon's head. We have Joyce and Murray reuniting to track down the presumed dead Hopper, but the bigger focus is really on Eleven and her initial inability to fit in at school that eventually has near-disastrous consequences at the local roller rink. And yes, we do bring in Mike, visiting from Hawkins, the long-distance boyfriend who doesn't seem to realize you never end a note to a long-term girlfriend with just from. So he's left hanging more with Will, the kid with the worst haircut, and it wouldn't matter if the year was 1986, 2026, or 1666, it's just an awful haircut. But probably not as awful as he feels about dealing with what are likely his suppressed feelings for his best friend Mike. Meanwhile, Jonathan's become a near non-entity. He's mostly getting high with his new buddy, Pizza Guy Argyle, all as a way of dealing with how his long-distance relationship is in even worse shape than Mike's and Eleven's. But as that storyline splits, we also branch out to Hopper in Mother Russia, showing Jack Bauer-like intestinal fortitude as he endures torture at the hands of the classic Soviet military bad guys. And the plot that spins out there is that a guard is going to help him break out after making a deal with his Amerikansky girlfriend for 40 grand. But after that goes south, Hopper later realizes that the little gladiator-esque sport the Ruskies have been engaging in at the prison is actually the feeding time for a creature he knows all too well, the Demogorgon. And if I'm mispronouncing that, I'm not putting the right accent on the right syllable, deal with it. You know what I'm talking about. I don't care. Demogorgon, whatever. And of course, we have the other major plot thread, which is the one I led off with in the first place, Eleven. When Eleven returns to Hawkins Labs, essentially to get her powers back, but maybe to get her memories back, and what we learn about her past, and its horrifying impact on the present. So let me back up just a bit, maybe throw a few more bouquets at Stranger Things overall before discussing these storylines as they both diverge and eventually converge. Now, the first thing to talk about before any plot or cool homage or reference or whatever, it's the steady creative stream of new characters that the viewers find themselves embracing as much as any season one original. And I do mean major players, not someone like Dustin's mom or someone like that. So we go back to season two. That's when we added Max to the mix. Yes, I've used Max and Mix twice in this podcast. I don't care. I'll probably use it a third time. And you know what? We almost instantly loved her, even despite the fact she's a ginger. Now, who else popped up for the first time in season two? Well, I guess there was Max's brother, Billy, who maybe we didn't love quite as much, but he certainly played a big part in the previous season, haunting Max right up until, you know, this season. Then there was Murray. Of course, Murray. And Brett Gelman adds a special sort of crazy comedic zaniness to whatever he touches. From the most throwaway sitcom to, well, the series finale of Mad Men, even. And then we even got a little bit more with Lucas's younger sister, Erica, who first appeared in season two, but starts to play a bigger role in later seasons and episodes. And oh yeah, we do meet Dr. Sam Owens for the first time. That would be Paul Reiser, whose 80s cred is built on the Twin Towers of, well, My Two Dads, and also the Great 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 Alien sequel, which also came out in 1986, which is when this season takes place, coincidentally. We hop over to season three, and that is when we added Robin into the whole, you know, universe here. She became an instant fan favorite. Most of the other season three additions either didn't survive the season or simply just aren't factors anymore. You know, your Jake Buseys, your Carrie Elwayses, and such. So let's just get right to season four, which is why you're actually listening. Now, we can wave off the freshman year bullies like Angela and her unnamed crew. Who cares? Now, we do have a couple Russians dressing things up. Hey, see what I did there? Russian dressing. Hey, yeah, I'm lame. Anyway, we get Dimitri, the conniving prison guard who eventually does bond with Hopper. And then we have his man on the outside, the perpetually bad joking Yuri, who essentially steals every scene that he's in, which is really hard to do when you're sharing screen time with someone like Brett Gelman. So that's very impressive. Meanwhile, out in California, there's Jonathan's new buddy, the not-so-tightly-knit Argyle. And if we go to Hawkins Labs, there's... How shall we refer to him? Let's go by the credits for now and call him the Friendly Orderly for the moment. There'll be lots more to say about him later. But the biggest addition, in terms of screen time and maybe just plain old fun time, is good old Eddie Munson. Now, is he just a little bit too old to still be in high school? Well, you know, let's put it this way. Most of our kids here, probably all of our kids here, they're too old. I mean, the actual actors are now at least a minimum of five years older than what they should be, for the most part. If you take Mike, Justin, Will, Lucas, then put in like Max and 11, the average age of all the actors that play those characters is 19. Since they're all supposed to be roughly 14 to 15, see what I mean? The older kids, Jonathan, Nancy, Steve, and Robin, they're all supposed to be seniors at this point. The average age of those four actors is 27. So when you look at Eddie, and the actor who plays Eddie is Joseph Quinn, that actor is now 29. That puts him right in line with those aforementioned seniors there. I mean, dude, Joe Keery, the guy who plays Steve, he's 30. So you got that. But look, let's face it. Much the way I mocked season two for being very 80s in the sense, well, it was like most 80s sequels, basically telling the same story yet again, only costing way more money, but feeling cheaper and more gimmicky and less pure and true than the original. Think of all the high school movies from the 1980s. You know, let's go with, I don't know, The Breakfast Club. What do you think the average age of all those kids serving detention was? 21. only two of those actors were actually in their teens. The rest were in their mid-20s. Did I just stutter and say mid-20s? Better still, take a movie like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which, coincidentally, was also released just like Aliens in the year that this season's taking place, 1986. The average age of those three high schoolers was 24.3 years old. Look, you start going up and down the list of movies, from Fast Times at Ridgemont High to, well, pretty much every other John Hughes movie, and you'll discover that a major trope, tradition, whatever you want to call it, was casting adults as kids over and over. Now, it's not that this is just an 80s thing. We certainly had that in previous decades as well, but we certainly noticed it more during the 80s. Now, with Eddie, I'll confess I didn't warm up to him right out of the bag. That's just me. I'm sure others feel differently. I actually found the scene that introduced him to be... I know I said cliche once. I'll say it again. It was a little cliche. And it wasn't remotely as believable as most anyone else I'd met in the Stranger Things universe at that point. But you know what? He won me over when he was handling his Dungeon Master duties. The fact that one of the key characters in peril throughout this season is a totally new character whose initial impression, at least on me, was that of an a-hole, and I ended up caring as much about him as anyone I've followed on the show since season one, it really speaks volumes to both the writers and the actor. So a little huzzah for all folks concerned there. I mean, honestly, Eddie reminds me of so many dudes I've known over the years. And hell, if I had chosen the life of a burnout, I might have been an Eddie type myself. Maybe without as thick and lustrous a head of hair. I did have hair. Shut up, people. But in pure attitude, hell yeah. You know, I might not be quite as metal, but I'm still a rocker, baby. It's only appropriate that after a jangly, loud, and rather obnoxious guitar chord... But this is when I'll bring in our barrister buddy, Brian. Howdy there, Brian Man Choi. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good, and I'm one of the last in line with Dio and Eddie. So I'm glad to be here representing Dio with the devil horns.
Ah, the devil horns. I'm having flashbacks of so many denim jackets with metal iron-ons and such. Now, I had mentioned from the top that Stranger Things started out as a kind of a fusion hybrid of Stephen King and Steven Spielberg, with elements of Carpenter thrown in for good measure. And, you know, you can see that sci-fi fantasy elements were part of the show from the get-go. I mean, the very concept of the upside down, the flip side, alternate parallel universe, yeah, you can find that in a number of places. But if you're a Stephen King fan, you can't help but think of things like The Talisman, which, you know, they often refer to going between the universes, flipping, you know, as a major influence there. Even the early Dark Tower books. And come on, Suburban Kids is a Spielbergian staple, from E.T. to the Spielberg-produced Goonies, which is the show has been compared to a number of times. We saw that they leaned heavily into Carpenter's The Thing last season, you know, inching closer to horror than they had before. So then when you get to this season, they have hopped the bus and headed straight to Elm Street. Because they are hitting a number of nightmare notes here, especially Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, which I think might be my favorite of the Nightmare Elm movies, if I'm not mistaken. So there are definitely more moments of terror in this season that we had seen before, whether it be the gruesome deaths of Vecna's victims, or what really happened at Hawkins Labs. And when you have that element being ratcheted up, and as these characters are also getting older, themes are getting more mature, and thus the stakes start to feel even more dire. Now, I know that in all the previous seasons, the universe was always at a horrible, cataclysmic, end-of-the-world level before. But when it's these horror elements, it feels more personal. It's more selective, much like the way Vecna is targeting victims. It's more visceral as a result of that. Now, however, and this is where I will fold in one of my... critiques of the season. Minor, occasional. I won't have that many. Or should I should say part one of the season. So annoying. The one thing that works against the horror element here is the overall overstuffed nature of the entire saga. And that's just it. I said saga. And Stranger Things really should not be a saga. I mean, I am not one to complain about getting too much of a good thing necessarily. Hence, like when we all got together and we were talking about the Batman movie a few months ago, I was saying, I'm not complaining about getting more Batman. But here, when it's a TV series and you're not just talking about an extra, you know, 20 minutes, it reminds me of the problem I and many others have had. It's not just a Scott thing. We've had with many a Netflix show in the past, kind of like those MCU ones I've mentioned a number of times, where you have a 13-episode season that should just be 10 or 8 or even 6, because all that extra time weighs everything down and it sags as a result. And the problem here is that the storylines are not even remotely given equal weight, which in of itself is fine, because you're always going to have A plots and B plots and C plots. I get that. Totally fine with that. But when you do that, you end up wasting some characters. And some characters this season have, there's no way to get around that they've been utterly wasted compared to even how they've been used before. I mean, as we get into the different storylines, we'll certainly address that when it comes up. And I got that little bit of negativity out there just now, because I also want to say I still vastly enjoyed this season. I would take it in a heartbeat, so far at least, over season 2. I might prefer it over season 3 so far as well. I'm not totally sold on that yet. I want to wait for the final 2 episodes, but I think, which I believe will be like 17 hours each. But I think this is, so far this is shaping up to be the best season since the initial one of season 1. So with all that, now I will let Brian speak, because he's been chomping at the bit, or the tobacco bit there, to say something.
No, I'd just say I agree with you. It might be my favorite season since season 1, but to quote my son, Quentin, I asked Quentin where it ranked, and he said he was waiting to see how it finished, but he'd really enjoyed it to see how it finished. I really like it. The only frustration I've had, and it's minor, is at first, like, they go to get Hopper pretty quick, and that drags on, like, a little too long. Like, it stretches over several episodes, and I mean, I didn't expect them to go to Russia and back in one day, but it's like sort of like Game of Thrones. They get on the plane, and next thing you know, it's going down there in Russia, and then it's still like a while before we get to Hopper. Mm-hmm. So I think I was a little frustrated by that. But that being said, I still thought it was pretty cool. And we get the one good thing about that is the actor who plays the, you know, crazy conspiracy guy. And I think, if I'm wrong, correct me, I think it's Barton Gellman. Who's that actor? Is that right?
Brett Gelman.
Okay, Brett Gelman. He gets to flex some pretty cool comedic chops. There's some good stuff with him that I enjoy. So I mean, it's not a wasted trip, but I just, you know, with the stakes of what's happening with the kids, I think you could have put more of that on screen and a little less of the trip to Russia. Mm-hmm. That's my only complaint, but I will say, and I've seen some stuff and heard some stuff that I totally disagree with people slamming on the new characters, for an 80s show to include Eddie and Argyle. Like, did you not watch 80s movies? Like, you know, 80s movies had the long haired stoner and had the rock and roll dude. And I found both those characters a joy, and I've enjoyed them in this season. I especially enjoy seeing a dude wearing rock and roll buttons and pins. And I put a article up on Facebook, I think in the Serious TV group, about like Ronnie James Dio's estate actually let, you know, the character have the vest and the patch for Stranger Things. So for me, And also another thing I really liked is it harkened back to the Satanic Panic. You see hints of that, of, oh, D&D is of Satan, and communities rallying that their kids are going to be taken over by Satan. And that, you know, for a kid of the 80s, those were real things. Like, you know, if you had D&D, people thought you were a weirdo. You know, if you listened to Dio, you were going to hell. And so, I mean, I've liked those elements of the 80s ring particularly true to me. And so I've really enjoyed it. And I think it's my favorite season since season one.
I don't think I can disagree with any of that. Spot on. Yeah. We'll dive even a little bit more into the issues, both good and bad, with the Russian storyline. Fairly soon. Not too soon. You know how these things go. But that is where I have some issues, and I have issues while still enjoying it. So it's like I'm critiquing it and I have problems with it, but it doesn't mean I didn't enjoy it. But, you know, but it could have been better. And again, we'll get to it when we get to it. So with all that said, let's reverse engines here and let's sink our teeth into this syrup soaked ego of a season with the first storyline I want to talk about here. So let's kick things off talking about all those kids and murders and Hawkins, because that's where a lot of the guts of the story lies here. No pun intended for any guts that we might see in the story. Or am I thinking of the boys right now? I've got the gore from the boys in my head trying to talk about this PG show, comparatively speaking. But a lot of the heart of the show is following, you know, the storylines of, you know, the aforementioned Eddie and, of course, you know, and Max, but then you've got Dustin and all the stuff that goes on in Hawkins, and where, you know, where it's kind of like if this was a Sunnydale. Is it Sunnydale from Buffy? This is where the Hellmouth is, essentially. It's Hawkins. They're probably separated by a mountainside, or if it was done by Zack Snyder, it's separated by a river. Anyway. Wow, I'm geeking out with references right and left here. Oh my god. I think I just lost an eyeball on that one. Anyway, I would say of the different storylines that are going through this season, this is, to me, I like the fact that this is the one I'm kicking off with. It's the main one in my mind, because I think it's the strongest one that we follow for the entire season. I don't know if I have any issues or quibbles with it whatsoever. I vastly enjoy so much about it, both in terms of the plotting, the menace, and all the character work that's being done with the different kids. And I don't mind. I enjoy the relationship-y stuff too. You know, will Steve and Nancy get back together or not? You know, well, what about Lucas and Max? Or, you know, I mean, maybe the guys on the basketball team are a little bit, but they feel, you know what? They feel so 80s. I don't mind it. You know, even if they're a little corny, it's like, all right, they're 80s. I'm okay with that. And we got to kill one of them, so I'm good with that too.
Yeah. It's like Revenge of the Nerds, except instead of, you know, getting slime dumped on them, like one of them gets to die and, you know, the rest of them are in real peril. But it's one of those things that I wonder my 16-year-old son watches it and enjoys it, but doesn't get the tropes that you and me get. I wonder if people like the 80s stuff, you know, there was always the jock that picked on the kids. There was, that was a mainstay. And often it was in romantic comedies or comedies. And, you know, the tables were turned to see that dynamic in a more disturbing setting of an 80s sort of horror genre mashup. It works quite a bit.
Right. Usually if you saw it in something that was more horror-wise, it would be, oh, I mentioned John Carpenter before, so maybe something like Christine, you know, where, you know, a geekier, nerdier guy was getting picked on and whatever, and where that leads. Or maybe you might see elements of that sometimes in the occasional slasher movie, perhaps.
You know, right. And you actually sort of see an homage to Christine in the, you know, in the labs.
Right, absolutely. But one of the things that people, because, you know, there are always those plot lines or stories or scenes that get everybody talking. You know, there's wait till we talk about me and Jamie talk about The Boys later this week. That show kicks off with one in the first 12 minutes. But to be a bit more serious, there's at least one, there's probably more than one, but there's definitely one that people were talking about from this first little run on Stranger Things. And that involves Max, and it involves her, in the world of the Upside Down, and her trying to escape it. And it's become probably the most talked about thing because of the use of music. And you are more musically inclined than I am. So the one thing I thought was interesting this season, outside of that music usage, which again, I'm going to leave to you to talk about in a second. And maybe I was almost happy about this. Even though there were other tracks used during the season, they certainly were. I didn't feel as inundated this season as I have in the past, where I remember watching it before and going, okay, how big a budget does this show have? Because I feel I've watched, you know, 20 minutes of the show and they somehow use 10 different songs, which isn't even possible because it's only 20 minutes. You know, we'll use a minute here and 30 seconds there, or whatever. It's like, get every artist possible. But here, I'm always appreciative when a movie or a TV series or TV episode can it's not just that they'll have music on the soundtrack, but they use it to great effect. I can go back to when you and I discussed the series finale of The Americans, and how much we enjoyed the use of what could have been a very overplayed U2 song, but it's used so well there, it works perfectly. Or you can go to the first season of Legion and the way music is used in that, where there's literally words and notes being used as weapons and stuff. Or when we've talked about other things, be it movie or TV shows, where the song is important because of what it means to the character. And here, it's so important for that character because it is literally what is going to save her, is her attachment to that song. So I'll let you talk about it, because I knew the song, so I'm not that stupid. I did know the song. It wasn't something that was in my regular playlist, but I did know the song.
No, I love that, and I love when a song or something is used, and it's not just like used for that segment. And I don't know that I've seen a song used in a show like this much. That song, it's almost like when you watch, if you were watching musical theater or opera or something, where like certain notes indicate like that character, you would hear that song and it attaches to Max, and it's sort of Max's theme for the season. Right. The song is, it's a wonderful song. Kate Bush is, an artist. She's not a pop song singer. I think probably her most popular thing ever was, the duet she did with Peter Gabriel.
Don't Give Up.
Don't Give Up. She never sought like sort of the pop mainstream. The album that song is on, Hounds of Love, is fantastic. If you just listen to that song, there's great stuff on several albums of hers. To see her sort of be rocketed by this, to give them such generous use of this song, and the payback to her, I think she went to streaming number one, like her streams have went up 8,000%. But it Max's connection to the song is wonderful. And when it culminated, I can imagine Kate Bush being thrilled to hear her song on Stranger Things. And I read an interview where she said she let him use it because she liked the show. When they asked, she liked it. So she's like, okay. But I can't imagine when she saw that cinematic piece of Max running for the opening and her song playing and the rocks crashing, that looks every bit like a Marvel blockbuster, that looks like, and to see that and manifest in such a weighty use of it, I just thought it was freaking beautiful. It was brilliant. And you know, that it paid respect to the song. The song aided the scene, and it was just seamless. It was one of the best uses of music that I've ever seen.
Right. Absolutely agree. The closest I can think to it that comes to mind, be it recently or years ago, a bigger deal here, of course, but it reminds me a little bit of when we were talking about the use of the Nirvana song in the Batman movie and how they ended up also, I think Giacchone, whatever, ended up stripping it out and doing kind of a melodic or classical version of the Nirvana song peppered throughout. So it became kind of almost part of the Batman or Bruce Wayne theme. The only other thing that ever comes to mind that where you'd hear something being repeated throughout the course of the series, maybe the first two seasons of Peaky Blinders, when they would bring in another artist, I think it was Jack White season one and PJ Harvey season two. And outside of, obviously, the opening is with the Nick Cave version, the original version of Red Right Hand, love that song. But then you'd hear either Jack White or PJ Harvey kind of riffing on that song, and they would sprinkle it throughout. If I'm remembering correctly, it's been a while. I believe they sprinkled throughout the series. Just for like dramatic structure, whatever. But here, what makes this a bigger deal than most any other use that comes to mind is just how it plays such an important part of the story, of the plot, and of the character. When you get that synthesis of plot and character, and it's integral. I'm wondering how much they. I think I read part of an article with her too, but they're probably not going to get into numbers because, you know, as I mentioned in past podcasts, I have a licensing background. Part of me is going, you know, she could have gotten a pretty penny for that. I hope she didn't let them just do it for. There's no way they did it for free. Let's just put it that way.
No. I'm sure, but I'm sure she had no idea the way it would blow up.
That's why it reminded me of the Batman thing, because all of a sudden something in the way all of a sudden was topping the charts, and it's like that wasn't. I don't even think that was a single release from Nevermind way back when. It was. I mean, it's not exactly a peppy song. The only other thing that comes to mind if you go back in time to the final episode of Sopranos, and all of a sudden the Journey song blows up because everyone was talking about it, and no matter how, even people who were angry about the finale were still downloading or buying the song. It's very funny.
And I think an important part of Max and that song is that it also held meaning for me, because I was that kid, like when I got on a bus to go on a trip or something, I had my Walkman and I had my songs. And, you know, when I was that age, you know, music is still an important part of my life, but music was huge to me when I was the age of these kids. And it's kind of funny, a random fact that I figured out by seeing when they will graduate would be a year after I would have graduated. Like if I was in their high school, you know, I would have been a sophomore and they're freshmen. And the funny thing is, at the age they're at, like they're a year behind my son. Like there's this weird symmetry that me and Quentin are both within a year on either side of these kids. So that's what it's like when I was a kid, and he's seeing it through the eyes of being about that age. And I find it fascinating because I'm looking at things like Walkman that take me nostalgic, the songs of that time. And he's just seeing it, relating to it as a kid that age now. And, but the Walkman, and you see her, it's like, that's like her talisman. She's carrying that Walkman. And when things are getting rough, she's putting the headphones on, and, you know, it's just amazing. Like the use of that song, the way they did it, it just is amazing.
So I'm going to make one prediction before I move on to other things about the storyline. Well, it's not really a prediction because it's probably not going to happen. But the writer in me, I can't help it. So we've got two more episodes to go, and we know they're both, like, you know, super long, whatever. And now the thing that she's been having to do ever since they caught on to the whole music connection is keep, she has the song playing constantly. Even when she has the headphones off, you hear, that's when you keep hearing it here and there, which is really great. You know, it's a Walkman. We all had Walkmans. You know what happens with Walkmans? Batteries run out.
Yeah.
Batteries are going to run out. I mean, I will be, they don't have to, but I'm thinking it's right there. It's right
either there. That or your tape gets eaten.
Especially if you're, well, yeah, it could be that too. You're right. Yeah, right. It could be that too. Which means, oh God, we're going to have to hear people sing it. Oh no. So, oh no. I've seen that done on TV shows too. Like, I don't need to see that. So let's flip around with some of the other folks that are in this storyline. And one of the fun, interesting things that happens is where somehow Nancy and Robin become a little pair of detectives. It's like Lois Lane and Nancy Drew, you know, off together. And Nancy had not really met Robin before, I guess, from the way they're interacting. So it was interesting seeing the way the characters played it. I really was enjoying the actress who plays Robin's performance, because you can tell there's a certain nervousness about her, and she's one of those people, and we all know people like that, who as they get nervous, they start to talk more and more and faster, and they start just, it's like, there's no filter, and which is funny that she's doing that, and yet she does keep one, but she doesn't go as far as to say one thing. And I understand, because that's, you know, that's a deeply personal thing, but if you're in any way concerned that she might have the wrong idea about you and Steve, well, that would be the one way to set her straight, no pun intended, but this is 1986, you're not going to be so forthcoming with such information to someone that you genuinely don't know. It took a lot for her to say that to Steve, if I recall. So meanwhile, I keep thinking, I don't know if Nancy really thinks the two of you are together anyway. I'm waiting for them to do it, her to drop something in those last two. It's like, yeah, I know. maybe Nancy has a really excellent gaydar. Who knows? So let me get to the fun stuff. When they get dressed up, oh, it's more of Robin getting dressed up. And this is also one of the many echoes of season one, where they do things that we saw in season one. I think Eleven got dressed up from clothing from Nancy, and here it's Robin, and they go to the institution. Okay, so we got a couple things going on there. First of all, mentioned Nightmare on Elm Street. There's no way we could do this podcast without giving a shout out to Robert Englund showing up. You know, stunt casting there. And the fact that they play, it's Robert Englund, but they play the entire scene, and even the set decor and everything is like, okay, you're doing Silence of the Lambs here. I mean, everything from even the way the brick looks, I was expecting one of the inmates to throw a handful of spooge at them as they were walking by. And I think they were almost hinting that they were going to do that, and they don't do it. But it's obviously very Silence of the Lambs. But in case we didn't realize who it was who's actually behind glass, when he's actually scratching the table, is like, oh, look at that. They're going as far as, like, just in case you don't realize who this is, we're really going to make it clear we're making a reference to Freddy.
Yeah, it's a great homage. And it reminded me, you and I had a recent discussion about the way the show Mythic Quest casts Danny Pudi in like a role, the polar opposite of Abed from Community. Mm-hmm. He's like the anti, like in this, like he's, this guy's the anti Freddy. He's like the person Freddy has persecuted and got in his dreams and tortured, and is leaving him alive, and even references later, like, you know, I'll visit him again. But like he's like Freddy's victim. Right. In this, which is brilliant, and seeing him, the reveal, like, you know, you don't see his eyes, like, because he turns and his eyes are obviously sewn shut, and but it was brilliant casting, and I read somewhere, like, of all the people that appeared on the set, the Duffer brothers were like completely geeks when he showed up. Like, they were totally, you know, in awe that he was there and did it, and like they really enjoyed him being on set.
Oh, I could totally see that. It's so funny when I think back to the 80s, and the first time I saw Robert Englund was on V, And then we go, I went from that, then I saw my Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm like, okay, that's two very different roles for you, sir. But yeah, that it's just, it's a nice little piece of work having him in there. And then we get the flashback to the story from the 50s. And, you know, Ozark fans, we recognize the younger version of him as the perpetual sap dude from Ozark. Does he end up getting baptized in the final season and leaving with Richard Thomas's weird woman's, I don't know what's going on. I feel like he's about to join a cult, and he seems like a cult member. But that, yeah, we get that flashback story. Little do we know when we're first watching it, like, oh, we're going to return to this flashback story later on. There's a lot more going on here than we realize when we're with Robert Englund in his cell there. But we'll get there when we get there. So, I mean, again, there's a lot of stuff going on in this story, in this really thick storyline, which I feel they were able to really wrangle and control pretty well, even despite you had, this is the one that has probably the most characters and bouncing around off each other of any of them, from the D&D stuff and bringing Erica back into it. And she was a great cast addition a couple seasons ago. Even if it's infuriating that she kind of blows them up later on. And like, you've been with them for other things, don't you know? It's like, no, you're just a perpetual younger sister who just has to get on your older brother's nerves. And she, again, she's one of the many scene stealers on the series to begin with. But I mean, I was not a D&D guy myself. I don't even know if I knew anyone who was specifically. I guess there were a few kids I knew in high school that might have been part of it, but I wasn't that aware of it. But I'm familiar with it enough to be able to follow what's going on. I do know about it enough. And you mentioned, Mythic Quest. And of course, you know, when you think Mythic Quest, then we also think Community, and they certainly riffed on this on Community,
you
know,
yeah,
a number of times. So whatever I didn't know before, I certainly knew after watching Community. So it's a lot of fun the way they once again incorporate that into the show, because that's been part of the show since season one, once again. Because, you know, it's interesting. They've done way more stuff with Dungeons and Dragons in four seasons of Stranger Things than they've done with video games. And which is fine. It's just for me personally, I think video games were kind of a bigger deal overall, it's not where they chose to go, which is fine, because there's a million places you could go that they didn't necessarily go to. I will say
I was a D&D guy, and had a group I played D&D with, and remember a family member had us all go to a church thing about how, like, we actually went to church for a thing about how it wasn't satanic, and we all went to it and immediately were like, this is even cooler. Like, after that was done, the same way that the backwards masking stuff, and people would go to churches and say, if you listen to Led Zeppelin backwards, and it's like, oh, well, cool. I like Led Zeppelin even more, you know, because of that. But, I think the thing that rings true to me of my experience is I got into video games in high school. And when I was younger, you'd want to get out of your house. Like, you know, TVs weren't in every room. You'd get on your bike. And, you know, we used to ride to this pond, and we'd ride to this pond, or we would go play in the woods. And I think these kids are coming of age that I probably, video games are going to enter the equation. But D&D is getting together with your friends and getting out of the house. You know, my house back then had one TV, and my dad ruled it with an iron thumb. So, you know, I think the only thing I ever got to watch was BJ and the Bear. So thanks, Dad.
Also, I mean, it's probably likely that while video games were a big thing, you know, coast to coast, of course, but it might have been even more so at times in more urban areas where it wasn't about, you know, running out and riding your bike up, you know, up through the mountains and wherever all these kids always seem to do from E.T. to this, whatever, where we didn't do that. you know, but we just went, we went around the corner. It's a little, you know, then in like suburban areas, you had to go to the arcade. You know, here it was like, no, it was right around the corner. It was at the local car service or the candy store, whatever. There was like every block, there was video games. They were everywhere, you know.
But again, we had pinball. We had pinball at the pizza place down the road. We'd ride our bikes and play either the Kiss pinball machine or 8-Ball Deluxe. Those were the two pinball machines of my youth.
Hey, we had the pinball too, dude. When we talk about Dungeons and Dragons, you all talk about wizards. The only wizard I ever was a pinball wizard, right? That's right. I came up with that on the spot. That's how good I am. All right, so. So getting back to this, like I said, it's a really, you know, burgeoning, thick with storyline. I really enjoyed how they handled pretty much most of it, and you know, and the fact that certain stories would rise to the top, like the Max story, especially when it culminates in that episode and from that point on. And then when we get interested in more in following the Robin and Nancy stuff, because that's uncovering the mystery of everything. So there's that, you know, there's that slight Scooby-Doo aspect to it, if you will. Why isn't no one wearing an ascot on the show? It's one of the storylines that they can afford to do outside of maybe Murray, and we'll get to him eventually. You can sprinkle in more comedy here between the interactions with, you know, Steve being frustrated. He keeps being left with the kids all the time. it's interesting because, you know, if we're playing the game of their high school freshman and he's high school senior, they're not really that many years apart, but they feel like they're many years apart. That might factor into what I mentioned earlier, the actual ages of the actors, when you realize, you know, people who are whining about the guy playing, you weren't here to hear it, you know, about how old the guy playing Eddie was. Like, hey, the guy playing Steve, he's a year older than him.
Exactly.
But I very much enjoy that. And also, and you had mentioned the just how great it looked, the scene with Max in the Upside Down. And I'll say that about a lot of this season. I haven't looked into what the budget was for this show, but I'm pretty damn certain it was pretty massive.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if Netflix is going to be throwing their money up against something, it's going to be one of their crown jewels, which Stranger Things is. And it's everything from, you know, and also things even cost more money in the era of COVID, because that just cost, that made every, you have to add those costs to everything you're doing. And there were scenes that were, well, they couldn't get an actor somewhere, and there were, the person was like on the other side of the freaking world, and they had to do some crazy filming and CGI, whatever, just to pull off. There's Billy. You know, Billy wasn't there. You know, I think Billy was in Australia, I heard, or something like that. But it looks great. I just really got a kick out of certain things. I love the little idea of whenever a potential victim would see would be that grandfather's clock somewhere. And literally the bell tolling for you kind of concept. So I really was enjoying the hell out of that. I could have lived with that. If the story had just been that storyline only, I would have been okay with it.
Yeah, and the chemistry, I mean, we may not like the decisions they made to split characters and where they went, but this season, I thought the chemistry of all the characters clicked. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned Scooby-Doo, and I was sitting here thinking, you know, you had potentially Daphne and Velma going off and then coming back with, you know, Fred, who's Steve, and then you have the goofy stoner Shaggy, who's Eddie. And you sort of have the Scooby-Doo connection, but it's like they're doing an investigation. They're sort of doing the investigation that leads them to the gate. And the chemistry was great. I just really enjoyed the storyline. And I like, to bounce off something you said earlier, I like that the character, I forget her name, doesn't tell Nancy like her secret.
Robin.
Robin. She just sort of says, you know, she's sort of like, you know, look, here are the facts. Like, there's no way we're together. And Nancy gets over it pretty quick and then sees how fierce she is in that administrator's office at the psych hospital. And you see it. You see a sign of Robin where she just is a total badass. And a great scene. And from then on, the chemistry was wonderful. And I thought all the chemistry in the cast this season was great. I don't think they made any decisions that for me didn't work. But I will say I loved the setup you're talking about when a character knows like that their time's almost near. That was a great device because you as the audience then know when it's coming for a character. And the one thing this season that was shocking was the degree of brutality when people died. Like the you know, especially, and I don't know why. I mean, I've broken an arm, I've torn up a knee. And so when I see bones break, I know what that feels like. So inherently, I get a little sick at my stomach. But the thing that really bothered me was like the jaw, when their jaw would like dislocate and crack to the side. And that took this to a new level that was just sort of terrifying when you'd see that. And the rise up in the air, you know, right, where they would start to float. I thought that was a great device because you know when something's about to happen that the character's in danger.
Right. And that's usually the last thing that happens before, you know, crick, crack, boom.
Yeah.
The bones breaking, the first thing I thought of when we first see, I guess it's in the very first episode, when it happens to Chrissy, my mind immediately went to season two? I think it's late end of season two of Oz, where I think it's Beecher has his arms and legs broken, and, you know, the visceral just to crack and whatever. So whenever that's depicted in anything from that point on, that's the first thing I think of. What happens with the jawline and the distension of it and the distortion of it, my mind went right to, and they already dipped their toes in this water before, as I mentioned earlier. It's John Carpenter's The Thing, when you'd see during the transformation how the faces would be distorted and the jawline would be kind of like, you know, all mangled and whatever. It very much had that look to it. I think the shocking one for me was not Chrissy, because we knew something was going to happen to her from the moment they introduced her character. I think the surprise was when it was the kid who was with Nancy from the school newspaper, and when he's first haunted by someone at the door, like, wait, this kid, because they had already established him as a character, and he was just kind of like this, you know, whatever, nice but annoying kid and whatever, and it's like, wait, what dark thing could he have? And then we find out, and then it happens, and it's like, oh, they're killing kids! They're killing kids! You know, where's Pennywise? They're killing kids here!
Yeah, and I kind of felt like the basketball player who wasn't one of the worst, you know, when he gets killed in the lake, like that's kind of a surprise. And, you know, you want the really bad basketball player for it to happen to him.
Or the guy wearing the hat. I would have been happy if it was the guy wearing the hat. He's not the main one, but he's just annoyed me. Let me throw out and if any other geeky things or anything occurs to us about this storyline or the others, we can certainly circle back, but I want to move forward. But since I do love making my geeky references known here, and I said we wouldn't cover most Easter eggs, but if they popped into my head, I will mention them from time to time. Kept talking about the D&D Club, whatever. Gotta point out that they're named the Hellfire Club. Hellfire Club, that's taken directly from the X-Men. And you go back to season one, I think it was, where this whole thing between Dustin and Will, a deal they make for a certain issue of the X-Men, and that issue of the X-Men, as I did look this up because that's the part I was curious about, is an issue with the Hellfire Club. So it all comes around. There's a loop. All right. So we, even though, again, obviously, if anything else occurs to us, we can bounce back to this whenever we want, but I think we need to head to the other coast. And by that, I mean we got to give some California love to the Byers family and 11 that are in Cali now. So the setup here is 11 trying to essentially assimilate into society, and how she's not really able to do that because kids are horrible, horrible, horrible monsters. She thinks she's a monster. No, kids are monsters. You're okay. Trust me. So let's talk about what takes place in California, not beyond there necessarily, because you've got all that between the Byers family. You've got Joyce wondering about Hopper, and then she eventually tracks down Murray as well. And then you have Mike from Hawkins, Indiana, showing up, and you have all these like reversals of things from previous seasons going on here. And we see how different people are dealing with their respective long-distance relationships, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast. So this would be one of the parts I have some issues with. They're not major, but I can't ignore them at the same time. Since I'm talking, I'll just get it out of the way now. It's interesting. Okay, let me put it this way. It's one thing if I'm watching season 2 of The Wire, and McNulty was a major character in season 1, but he's kind of relegated to being more of a side character in season 2 because the focus has shifted somewhere else and we're dealing with other players now. While he's still there, and it's actually a very cunning and genius thing that they do on The Wire, but he's still a presence, and he's still there. I go to Stranger Things. Jonathan was a pretty major important character in this series. You know, whatever season you want to pick. Jonathan is pretty much nullified this season. Can anyone think of anything Jonathan does that's really of any consequence? Really? I mean, the most interesting thing about Jonathan is his new friend, Argyle. That's what makes Jonathan and Jonathan being high when they're having dinner, and I guess one could say, oh, this is the part of Jonathan's life where he's getting high. I was like, yeah, but that's 7 episodes, and he doesn't really play much of a part in it, so I'm just kind of like, eh. So that's I'm gonna keep on this track. I'm gonna get all my negativity out right now. That's a major fault I feel. It's one thing not to be carrying one of the major stories. That's okay, but not when I feel that you're kind of just wasted and they don't know what to do with you. Which leads me to someone else in that whole Byers family is screwed, quite frankly, because of Joyce. Joyce, Winona Ryder, who has actually been giving a very interesting performance throughout this series. I never know if she's great or not, but I enjoy it nonetheless, because I was like, I believe it. I very much believe her performance. Oh, and you go back to season 1. She's tremendous in season 1. Is it just me? Now, look, you mentioned it before, and we're going to be talking about it soon. We're getting there with the whole Hopper and Russia stuff, whatever. And love, love, love Murray. Murray makes those scenes infinitely watchable. But doesn't it at the same time kind of feel like we're relegating the character of Joyce and Winona Ryder to this kind of like this goofy second banana status that she doesn't really... It feels like there's no weight to what she's doing. And the fact that, like you mentioned earlier, that storyline is dragged out does not help that matter. I will forgive other things. Like, you know, it's funny how she just disappears and it's like, oh, I'm just going to... Well, it's like, you know, I'm fine with that. I'm okay with that because there are things that are fine. This isn't real life. I don't care. She's got a kid at home who's supposed to be at least 17. I think Jonathan's supposed to be like 17 or 18, whatever. So there is a quote unquote adultish person there. It's okay for her to do that, you know. I just felt like I don't as much as I enjoy Murray's performances, I kept going, it was like what you were saying before. This is going on too long. It's being stretched out too much. I enjoyed it. I mean, the Yuri stuff was amazing. I love Yuri as a character, but oh my God, we got to the end of the thing, and I kept going, wait a minute, are they still in Russia? Have they still not gotten out? Oh my God, he might as well be, what's his name, in season four of Game of Thrones, and he's, you know, all he's doing is, oh, let's cut his dick off now. it's going on forever. Anyway, I'll stop now. I'll let you talk.
I agree with you. I think the saddest sidelining is Jonathan, and I mean he's and I wonder if like it's you know his availability or something was going on, but they even you know go out of their way to say like he's saying maybe I don't want to be with Nancy anymore and I'm not going to go to college where she wants to go to college, and you know that they kind of cop him out in a way that to me was disappointing because you know he wanted to be with her and that was such a big storyline that it just sort of gets thrown away like it, you know, and of course it opens the way for her and Steve is the more charismatic, likable character to a lot of people, but the casual way that he sort of throws that away and sort of Argyle becomes the new version of him that gets the funny lines, that's more sort of the center of attention, is disappointing. And with Joyce, I think the thing that's once they get in the airplane, what you know, all the stuff in Russia, it's all Murray's plan. She's doing what Murray says, and she is just sort of like riding shotgun to him. And the most consequential thing she does, which is a big thing, but you know, it's just she pushes the right buttons to save Hopper. Like that's the big thing she does, right?
All right, she might as well be Kate Capshaw in Temple of Doom. Just like you know, she might press a button by accident, but she's it just feels very wasteful. Especially, you got Winona Ryder; she's still somebody. I mean, she's not shoplifting anymore. You know, come on.
I agree with you that like in this, I mean, it's like Nicolas Cage. Like, is it great or is it not? I don't know, but it's always compelling.
Yes,
like you know, like. She commits to make the choice to portray Joyce in a way that is compelling. And the thing I really hated was like when they were watching the Demogorgon fight and like all they do is like just show her like making eyes at Hopper like oh look I'm so scared and you know she's the damsel in distress even though she's not really in distress and
right.
And Murray's getting all the good lines and all the good stuff
right which is fine because they're if they're queuing them up as comedic lines it's fine. I just felt that she didn't have enough to do dramatically, which seemed odd because she certainly had a potential dramatic storyline there. I felt the execution just seemed to be played for laughs almost the entire time, which seemed odd to me when you contrast that when we would switch from that to Hopper actually in prison because there was little if anything funny there. So it just seemed maybe it was a tonal thing, and that's always a tricky thing whatever you're doing movie or TV, especially TV shows, about how you can veer in tone at times. And there are shows that can get away with it, and there are some that don't. So getting back to the because we have other people here. I mean, obviously the 11 in. I guess, again, we're asserting that she is probably their freshman in high school. I think they're all like ninth grade or something.
Right.
So they're out of. They're not. It's not middle school. It's high school. So that's the difference of experience. And so you get the whole Carrie routine with her at the roller rink. Except instead of doing the, I think she had already, was it there she tries to do the hand thing and it doesn't work, or was it in a previous scene that she tried?
No, she did it at the school grounds after they trashed her diorama of Hopper.
Yeah, the diorama. I kept going, the diorama is one of the things that had made me think, wait a minute, how old are they? Because I keep thinking of a diorama being something you do when you're very young. I keep thinking, are we still doing dioramas in high school? That seems to be more of a grade school thing to me. Like, oh, look, it's the first Thanksgiving or something like that.
Although you do them if you attend Greendale, so.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, there you go. And you try not to step in hot lava. So I kind of I enjoy that in the sense that they go out of their way to not let the audience get that moment of satisfaction of her getting back at them. And when she does, it takes such a horrific turn where it's like, oh, I mean, for a moment you're like, yeah, got the roller skate to the face. And then you're like, oh, and you realize this is not going to go well for her.
Right.
You know? But I think they kind of flip things because I think in season one, it's Mike who's actually getting bullied at school or something, and he's the one lying about his situation to her. And that's when she gets on him about, you know, lying to her and stuff. And now, you know, once again, there's a reversal going on here. Once she leaves, it does feel like I don't know why we're even here anymore, because the remaining characters are like, I mean, to me, Will has always been the least interesting character on the show, of the kids anyway. The fact that they've kind of folded in this, or there's suggestions of something else going on with him, is interesting, I'll give it that. But I've still just never found him very interesting compared to Mike or Dustin or Lucas. And maybe that's the character he plays. You know, he's kind of the least interesting one of them. And the only thing that made him interesting is, oh, you're the one who gets possessed and becomes all that stuff. Or you end up with that haircut. I spent a lot of time mocking the haircut earlier. You missed it. it may very well be the worst haircut I've ever seen on a TV series.
He's an interesting character because they make him intentionally. He's always been the quiet, withdrawn one,
right?
And it's hard to be it's hard to stand out when you're that character. And you know, there, like you said, there are hints in the conversation he has with Mike when he's talking about what happened to us. We used to be friends, and he sort of, I think, is his alienation is not just California, where it seems to be where it's headed.
Yeah.
And I think there could be a real interesting conversation between him and Robin when they hook back up, if that's the thing that's being suggested.
I feel like they're hinting at it. The way their conversations have gone, they've certainly dropped a couple little references just to be like, oh, you know, look at the, if you freeze the frame, the screen, and you see the thing, the project he's carrying, he's doing a project based on Alan Turing, the code breaker from World War II. And maybe people saw that Benedict Cumberbatch movie a few years ago. And what was that story really about? It was about someone who was closeted and, you know, how he was dealing with that. And these things are not coincidences. And
no.
It would be weird to do that as a red herring. That would really kind of be kind of, because I like the idea of them doing this because he's at an age where this could be a thing.
Yeah.
And then we have to remember how old he is, and then remember this is the mid-80s. What was going on in 86 and such. That's,
oh yeah, that's, I mean, I can tell you, I went to school with people that didn't come out until, you know, they left my high school and left where we live because of the way it is here. And I should say the way it was, it's slightly better. It's not, you know, a lot better, but it's better. But, you know, even amongst your friends, if someone finds out, that could, you know, ruin you. And in that time frame, it was a way different world than it is even now.
Right. I mean, people still run into problems, you know, from coast to coast for things of this nature, unfortunately, still. You know, Matthew Shepard was not that long ago.
Right.
But in 1986, I mean, oof. So, I mean, I don't really feel there's a lot more to dive into here. We both kind of enjoyed the Argyle character. I mean, he's a little one note, but I still enjoyed him because I wasn't inundated with him. The only problem was he just stood out as like, oh, you stand out so much more than Jonathan does now. I'm kind of wondering what the point of Jonathan is it right now. Like
I was going to say he's Quentin's favorite character. Loves him. Quentin thinks. I mean, like for his age, you know, sort of the clueless, vacant stoner kid. Like he just thinks he's hilarious. And I will say the trek they go on, like some of the comedy he plays and the way he plays it, it is really good. But like you say, I mean, it sort of reduces Jonathan to a background player. And if I don't know if we're going to talk about it later, but if we're not, I would like to say there is that delightfully zany shot of delightfully zany sequence in the, you know, the house with the computer and the kids and enlisting all the kids to run sort of a crazy madcap, you know, thing to get access to the computer.
I was confused about that. So is that like some giant foster home? Is that why there was like all these kids there?
Is that what I think they were trying to suggest that they were Mormons, so they had a lot of kids.
Mormons.
Yeah.
Because they go to Salt Lake.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm smart. I did not even pick up on that. That's how dumb I am. First, I didn't get that the opening was actually a mystery, and now I didn't get that. See, I you know what? I didn't have my, you know, that kind of hat on when I watched Stranger Things. I wasn't like, oh, this is, I have to start to unravel things and be all Mr. Smarty Party here. So thank you for, good thing I didn't do it solo. I would have just totally fucked that up. Anyway, I would have said, oh, so clearly, you know, they're in a foster. I'm like, no, it's a moment. You know. All right. So there, you brought it up there. There you go. Good for you. So since we already mentioned it and I don't feel the need to break from music just now, let's go right to Hopper in prison, because there are some things I really enjoyed David Harbour on this show altogether. And I like him here too. And does it go on a little longer than we'd like it to? A little bit. I'll give him credit for this. I love the idea that here we go, we're building up to this escape plan. He actually pulls it off, and then he's screwed, and he's brought back again. I really like the frustrating aspect of that. It's like, oh, it's Steve McQueen in The Great Escape. He does all this, and then, oh, he's going to come right back. And I believe they make a reference to the Cooler King in there, if I'm not mistaken, which made me happy, I'm sure. I was like, hey, a reference that's not from the 80s? Well, way to go, guys. But we were watching it on TV on local channels in the 80s. There you go. It's just, I did not expect that it was going to take the entire 7 episodes. And quite frankly, are they even out at the end? I don't even remember. They're still there, right?
I don't think they've left the prison yet. Or if they have, they've just left the prison, if I remember right. I think they're not out of Russia.
I think another door closed. Like, did they take the Sarah Palin route to get there? How are they doing that? You know, Alaska, whatever. See, I made a contemporary. Well, that's not really contemporary.
I thought the thing I liked about David Harbour, and maybe I didn't have as many problems with his portions of it as with the Joyce and Murray part,
yeah,
is he's been in that prison a long time. So, we hadn't seen him. Like,
right,
we saw, like, you know, the hint he was alive after the big explosion, right? Like, so, you know, if you spend a little more time with him the whole time he's been there, it's like Joyce and Murray get on a plane and go there, and that takes as long as the rest of everything else. And he's been in the prison the whole time. So I liked his performance because I thought he was deliciously understated, such that, like, you know, when he gets that alcohol and he gets that lighter, like, that's the first, like, twinkle in his eye that we see. Like he seems like he's completely beaten and defeated and he's down. But then you get that little twinkle, and like he's got a plan, and he knows how to fight one of them. And so I like his performance and the choices he made and the way he stayed understated. And, you know, like I talking about 80s homages, I mean, a lot of this sort of reminded me of like what was it? I don't want to say, is it Midnight Run?
Which movie are you talking about? Midnight Run's what, De Niro and Grodin.
One with De Niro. I can't think of the name of it. It's the one where the guy gets busted for drugs and he's in prison. It's a prison movie. I can't think of the name of it. But you know, I mean, in the 80s, there were a lot of prison movies.
Yes.
You know, like what it's like in prison. And
Brubaker.
Yeah. Brubaker. Well, I mean, you know, like along that line, there were a lot of those. And you know, him sort of getting to know the guard. I do like that the guard that was going to get him out goes in with him. I thought that was a cool twist.
It's one of those things, I liked it. I just, in my mind, especially considering just how long these episodes were, because, I mean, wasn't like the shortest one like an hour and 15 minutes or something like that. They seem to get progressively longer as it went along, which is fine, but that means, you know, I watched 7 episodes, which probably means you gave me at least 8, well, probably more like 9 hours of stuff. I kind of felt the storyline could have been done within the confines of 4 episodes, maybe 5. And yet took all 7. I get it, because maybe they wanted to, where they wanted to leave things off. I get that. All right, then maybe you hold off on showing him to me for an episode or two. Maybe then you shock me by season 2, like, oh my god, Hopper. You know, that's just me. You know, again, part of me doesn't want to complain because I really enjoyed David Harbour's performance. Not just like you were saying, but I just felt that was kind of like, come on, get on with it, get on with it.
Yeah, I totally agree. But I will say the stuff we did get was enjoyable. You know, like it's not like it drug on and bored me. It's just, and I think that the main storyline of Vecna was so compelling that sometimes when we diverted from that, I wanted to get back to it.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that as well. All right. So we've talked about Hopper in prison. So if we're going to talk about prisons, that does lead us to one final destination. And no, I'm not talking about the prison of one's mind. I'm talking about Hawk and the Lads. I'm talking about where Eleven goes. So this is what kicks off the season. This would be if the Vecna storyline is plot A or the number one plot, this is 1A. One might reverse those, depending how you look at it, since I would say Eleven is the quote-unquote main character of Stranger Things. She has kind of remained in that slot since season 1. You know, you could have said that about Mike to a certain extent at Once Upon a Time, but certainly not now. So she gets returned after Dr. Owens finds her, and actually he's responsible for her relocation, so he arranges to meet her, and I guess he's got his own set of people and operatives are working on his behalf, which is in conflict with other forces, you know, within the government. I guess his is more the secret, they're kind of doing more rogue stuff, and the other people are finding... They believe she's actually responsible for the horror show that's going on in Hawkins and whatnot, whereas he knows that she might be the one thing that can help stop it, and which means we now have Matthew Modine is brought back into the fray, Dr. Brenner, the character that we have seen off and on for the past few seasons, and we're like, wait, interesting, because is he a good guy or is he a bad guy? Sometimes, oh, he's a good guy. Oh, no, he's a bad guy. No, I actually like that gray area he sits in, because there are things you can see, oh, he definitely does actually genuinely care, and there are so many other times like, no, he's a bad, bad person. you kind of just keep flipping back and forth there. The point of that storyline is supposed to be, this is how she is going to get her powers back. But what it does then that's plot. But character is about, we're going to find out more about her and what made her what she is. And we may uncover some things that if we don't find disturbing, she's going to find disturbing. And that's that opening scene we got. And then the way that scene plays out initially when we're watching, you're like, oh, okay, she has done some horrible, horrible things. And we eventually discover, no, it wasn't her. Now, I will say this. The very first time they introduced the orderly character and the way he speaks with her, look how dense I was about other things. I didn't even get there were Mormons, you know? I am not one to go, oh, I called that, whatever. I'm going to tell you right now, it seemed clear as day to me, like, oh, one of these things is not like the other. There's something more to him. And I was saying, like, and when he was talking with her when she was playing the thing that reminds me of, the Price is Right game.
Oh, like Plinko?
Plinko, thank you. I swear on my eventual grave, I was thinking, he's number one. That's what it's going to be. He's the one. He is literally the one. And I'm just waiting for it.
I had the same thought. The cool twist is there's a twist on the twist, though.
Yes.
Like,
oh,
like,
yeah.
Now, I didn't call.
Oh, I didn't see that. No. I wish I had seen it because I'd be so fucking proud of myself. I didn't see that.
Well, I'll tell you, the funny thing is Quentin. Quentin asked for my password at midnight. And I think we might have been recording Saul when that happened. I think it was last time we were recording, he said, hey, Dad, what's the Netflix password?
Right.
And he started watching at like 12:01 and stayed up. And like by the like day or two later, he was done. And I started watching it. And he goes, are you watching? I said, yeah. And he said, you're not going to believe the twist at the end. So, like, you know, I figure out, like, they tell you he's number one. And I said, Quentin. Like, I knew he was number one. And he goes, oh, and like, doesn't let on. And yeah. Then it was over. The next day he went to his mom's and I texted him at night and I said, holy crap, you're right. And he said, see, I told you. Like that twist was, I thought he was talking about, like, he'd seen number one and that surprised him. So it shocked me when the next step happened and you find out actually, you know, what we're really seeing is the origin of Vecna. Like, exactly. that whole story is, and you don't know it. That's the origin story of the big bad.
That is where I felt, okay, I had mentioned at some point earlier in this podcast about the writing's never been airtight on Stranger Things. It's not. It's just not. But I will also give them their due when they deserve it. And that's that was the major twist that they deserve it on. The fact that I and so many others, we didn't see that coming. And it was right there. It's right there in front of us, and we didn't see it. It's like, I use the words about storylines being divergent until they converge, and this is how you got the storylines to converge in a rather major way. And then of course, it's almost like the end of a murder mystery when you see things play out. It's like, oh, you know, it's the end of The Sixth Sense. By the way, he was dead all the time. I just wanted to spoil it for somebody out there. although, I'm sorry. I'm going to make fun of that show later on. Anyway, wait for it. Star Wars fans, stay tuned. So, that reveal and how it's presented and the storytelling, it really works really well. Usually it's the time you can get away with an expositional dump like that because it's revelatory and it shows, oh, what you thought you saw is not what you saw.
Right.
And you're thinking, wait, is he an unreliable narrator? Or was the narration earlier the unreliable? It's like, no, that was before because her memories were all screwed up.
Right.
And Robert Englund's character, Creel, didn't know. He can't see anything anyway because his eyes are so shut. So Which is hinted at in the weird flash of Chrissy in the very first episode when her own dad also has his eyes sewn shut. Didn't remember that? Which is, yeah. You're like, why the hell are they doing that? And you see, oh, okay, that's a weird connection there. Right. So then you have this major battle that takes place between them, which then the first thing you're thinking of is, oh, this is like when Eleven is fighting the Demogorgon back in season one. I mean, even some of the nature of the fight even seems very similar. You know, he's thrown into the wall and goes through the wall. It just looks, and I think these things are done deliberately. They're done deliberately. I had mentioned at the top of the podcast that some people had issues with the fact that Eleven was talking so much in these flashbacks when we had been led to believe that she was, if not mute, then she spoke very little. And I know the creators, writers, the Duffers, or whoever, the Duffers, had come out and said that, no, she gets like that post-massacre. But here she was. And I was like, oh. Who cares? I don't care. We believe it or not, I don't care. I was impressed. What I said earlier, and I'll say it now that you're here. So guess what? I'm repeating myself. Same podcast. I was just impressed with them making her look like she's 9 years old again. I liked the very the CGI use of her. I thought they and the fact, and I also enjoyed the fact that they kept flipping back and forth. Okay, sometimes she's 9, sometimes she's 14 or 15 or however old she's supposed to be, and they just keep bouncing back and forth.
Yeah, and I like they did that, like, sometimes she'd look in, like, the window, and she would be 9, the reflection would be 9, but she would be an adult, like, yeah, and I think it was exactly what you're saying, like, what am I seeing here? Like, it was to sort of make you think, like, you know, is this what really happened? Is she reliving a memory? Is it happening now? And you don't, you know, you think you know what's happening, but until the very end, you're not sure.
Right. Oh, and by the way, just speaking of things from the 80s, Gus, they have her floating on the water and the whole thing, which is vaguely reminiscent of a sensory deprivation tank, whatever. And the first thing I think of that when I think of it, and people go like, oh, like on Fringe? Like, no, idiots, not like on Fringe. There was this movie called Altered States from the early 80s. I think William Hurt's in that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, he is.
Before Kiss of a Spider or whatever. I think it's the first time a lot of people ever found out or saw what a sensory deprivation tank was, and of course it has much different consequences in that movie than we've seen it since. So again, I just thought it was like, hey, look, we found a way to squeeze another 80s thing in here. There you go. Boop. Threw it in there. I really did enjoy this whole section. I liked finding out about stuff. Is there like, oh, look, oh, there's the, she is bullied back then too, wasn't she? Whatever. Sure. But it makes it, it here it kind of worked. It shows the horrors of what was going on there, what Brenner was doing with these kids with the electroshock thing and even shocking, the orderly. And then you start wondering, like, so he was number one, but they had him working there as an orderly. And you start wondering, you think, there's more to that too. Why would that be okay? And you start wondering, and whether they're going to peel that back or not in the final two episodes, or they're going to say, we're not going to tell you anything more. I don't know. I would think they have to touch on it somehow. There has to be an explanation for that. That seems very strange.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought that the story really was told well there at Hawkins Labs, because I thought, like, some of the little kids they had that were doing stuff, when stuff kind of got scary, like when he made them all stand in line and he's shocking, you know, the kid who orchestrated the attack on her. You see the little kids, you see the fear in these little kids, and it's really quite horrifying to see what he's putting these kids through, and to see all of that and imagine, you know, if that's what he's capable of, you know, like the gray becomes a little darker.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Kind of like that.
I will say the thing I liked,
Paul Reiser.
Yes, absolutely. I seeing him in that role, I wanted a little more of him in that sort of battling, you know, Matthew Modine's character to for the soul of 11, like, you know, hey, what are we doing here? Like you just seem to be torturing her. And I really liked his contribution.
Yeah, I vastly enjoyed his part in this as well. I had mentioned earlier how I love the idea of having Paul Reiser in it to begin with, because he's, although there are those who know him from Mad About You in the 90s, whatever, to me, I think 80s because of, you know, my two dads and Aliens more than anything else. But yeah, I very much enjoyed him in it. So, and we're left with, you know, cliffhanger on top of cliffhanger on top of cliffhanger, and we have to wait till July 1st that, you know, everyone's getting out of the upside down world. By the way, did Steve actually bite the head off a bat during that whole thing or not? Because I didn't actually see that, but then Eddie makes the Ozzy Osbourne comment. I said, I know he was ripping it apart and smashing it. Did he actually bite it? Did I miss that?
He bit one of the flying batch. Yeah,
it's funny because there are certain parts where you see all the sequences in the upside down, especially when all that stuff is attacking, and it's got a kind of an album covery kind of look to it. I mean, it might as well be Meatloaf Spat Out of Hell or something like that.
Yeah. Well, and I like. I think it's Robin that says something like, "Can we get rabies from this?" And,
oh, I love that.
You know, and like when I was a kid, it's like, you know, when we were kids, people worried about rabies like,
all the time.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. And I kept being warning. Oh, and there's these big needles, and you're gonna you have to there's giant shots for 7 weeks or 9 weeks or 70 weeks or
don't mess with that stray dog. You'll get rabies.
Well, I got bit right on that anyway. Is there anything else that you would like to mention about this before we start to wrap things up?
I would like to say there's one thing that I didn't think they addressed, and I think it was intentional. Steve got bit, and they show that wound at one point mm-hmm. before he's wrapped up. Mm-hmm. And that wound starts to look pretty gnarly, mm-hmm. like looks like the sort of same type of design as like the gates and that kind of creepy living material that you saw that started spreading in one of the earlier seasons. Like I think he's infected, and that's going to go somewhere pretty dark in the last two episodes.
That is a good thought. I was thinking about the bite as well. I had forgotten about the details of it, but I kept thinking, just in general, you got bit by something over there. Robin's rabies reference might not be too far off. Not rabies, but something far, far worse.
Right.
So I would not be shocked if they build upon that. I mean, I guess Nancy is still trapped over there. I believe that is Barb that we saw in the swimming pool, or some zombified version of Barb. I even went into IMDb to look up the actress to see if she had a credit for it, and she didn't. So I don't know if they actually used her or just some sort of prosthesis to look like her or not. I'm not sure. We still got to finish up at 11. There are, again, we've got two massive episodes waiting for us on July 1st. The question of whether they should have broken the season up the way they did, I don't mind. It's fine. Because the Netflix model of doing the entire dump like this, there are people who, that's the only way they like to watch series now, and there are other people who would prefer it gets spaced out. And yes, one can say, oh, you don't have to watch old ones, but yeah, but you risk being spoiled.
Exactly.
If you exist on any form of social media. I mean, I almost got spoiled on something from The Boys the same day it came out. I mean, I wasn't totally, there was a word, I was waiting for someone to have a certain reflexive action take place. You know, an involuntary reflexive action take place and what that might mean. And as I'm watching, it's like, oh, I think I know what it might mean, but I'm not sure. And then it happened and whatever. It didn't really spoil, it just kind of annoyed me. But that's what I'm talking about. Who knows what it could be? But by them doing this, it means people will at least be still be wondering or speculating about it for the next month. Maybe, I mean, within a week or two, it's probably going to die down because there's a rush of shows coming to fill the space in June. Everything from The Boys and Netflix, you'll have Peaky Blinders is finally going to be here, and Apple TV will have For All Mankind, and at the end of the month, Only Murders in the Building comes back, and there's so many Umbrella Academy. Oh my God, Umbrella Academy, I think, comes back this month too. Holy crap. There's a lot going on in June. Someone's getting married. I don't know.
No, but I will say, this is Netflix's biggest win in a long time. Like this show, as big as season one was, it exploded again. And I think I saw their numbers where this was the largest watch thing they've ever put out, like so far. Like right. This was the biggest premiere of viewing numbers of anything that they've had. So
the Fast and Furious is happening outside my.
I was going to say, apparently, Maverick's buzzing the tower. Yeah. So
New York, who knew? It's amazing that they would pull those numbers when the show actually debuted the same time as Obi-Wan Kenobi did on Disney Plus. So that makes it that much more impressive.
Yeah.
So wait a minute. So 10 years later, he looks like Alec Guinness. Is that what I'm talking? Okay, just you know, I'll go along with that. I like the way Ewan McGregor is stroking his beard and doing the Alec Guinness thing. Reminds me of how I used to do an Alec Guinness impression, which I will not do now, so don't even ask. One of these days, if I get a little drunk, I'll do a podcast and I'll alternate between James Mason and Alec Guinness, but not yet. The part of me is like going, but wait a minute. In Star Wars, and I'm not going to say A New Hope because I'm not an asshole. It's Star Wars. Anyone calls it A New Hope, go fuck themselves. It's Star Wars. Stop rebranding it. Star Wars. Fucking assholes. Fucking assholes. Anyway. It's like that. They did it with the Indiana. I noticed they did that with the Indiana Jones movies too. They went and changed. It's like, no, they changed like the Raiders of the Lost Ark. No. It's Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's not Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Shut the fuck up. It's fucking changing shit.
Get off his lawn.
But Star Wars. No, I'm sorry. You don't go back and change the name of a classic book decades later. You don't change the name of a painting decades later. You don't change the name of a fucking movie decades later. It's bullshit. Anyway. So, Star Wars. Two words. Title. That's it. Vader says, I sense a presence. A presence I haven't felt in... He wouldn't say that about someone he only ran into like 9-10 years ago. I'm sorry. It didn't. It's bothering me. It's because it seems like it should be a lot longer ago. He doesn't. It's like, huh? Oh, he's here. No, that's all I'm gonna say.
Unless they end up on Mustafar again.
Just and people are like, oh, and every other, and these are a lot of friends of mine. I don't know if anyone listens to the podcast. I don't care if they do or not. They don't, so fuck them. Like, I was like, oh, now we know why she named her son Ben. Really, you needed this to figure that out. Stop yourselves. Anyway, so if you enjoyed this podcast,
you know, to quote Bill Hicks, you know, he is available for children's parties.
So if you enjoyed this podcast, guess what? You'll enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Forgot the name of our page. Like the page and you can join the conversation about shows like, hey, Stranger Things or Better Call Saul or so many others. I have nothing to drink for the last hour, no wonder. Where can you find this podcast? Well, you're already listening to it. Why do I need to tell you? All right. You can find it wherever podcasts are found. You know, Spotify. Amazon. I don't think we're on Pandora. I think they want like a blood sample or something. I don't remember what. I won't do it. But better still, you can find all 345. Jesus Christ! Of our podcasts can be found on stvdpodcast.podbean. That's PODBEAN. In case you didn't know, all these years .com and. yeah, you can actually subscribe to it there too. You can listen to it on your phone. It looks really cool and shit, whatever. Find us on Instagram. Our Instagram handle is Serious TV Drama is one word. It would be nice to have more than 75 fucking followers, and like probably 8 of those are bots. Come on, motherfuckers. Twitter handle is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama. Next week, or later this week, Jamie and I will be in this ear space talking about the first 3 episodes of season 3 of The Boys. That should be quite the conversation. I've only watched 2. I haven't even watched the 3rd one yet. I can tell you right now, no spoilers on this podcast, because we're not talking about that show on this podcast. That would be wrong. But we will have a story for you about me contacting Jamie and my unwillingness to press play after 12 minutes of the first episode. I paused it and I was like, I won't do it. Can you just give me, can I skip ahead like 2 minutes? I'll do that. That's my teaser. So you can look forward to that. Oh, and I think, you know what? I'm just going to say it. I may be mistaken, but I think this would mark the first time that both myself and someone else who's a frequent co-host of this podcast, but that person, and that person would be Jamie, is doing another podcast about the same show. So, but in deference to, I do like at least 3 of the people on that podcast, so I will give her a shout out. Maybe after you listen to us, at some point you can track down Jamie. She will be appearing on the Crazy Hank Stranger Things podcast, which is going to be recorded Sunday night. I think you probably find it live on YouTube. You can actually watch it. They're all pros and shit. I think it's Jamie. I think it's Jack. I think it's Maddie Eichhoff, last time he appeared on this podcast was like 7 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. And some other guy, I think some guy I don't know how he's going to be able to talk, because he's usually like blowing Damon Lindelof or something. No, I kid. No one heard me say that. I'm going to get in trouble for that one. I don't even know the guy. Who the fuck cares? No one will tell him. Whatever. She'll be back here eventually. I'll give her shit for it. No, it's fine. Anyway, I'm glad you guys got to listen. This was the surprise impulsive podcast that we chose to do. And if you're wondering, hey, did you just decide to do this podcast because you heard Jamie was doing Stranger Things somewhere else? Yeah.
Now, defense of myself, I just was asked, you know, if I wanted to join it today, and ended up being an addition to the back end of the podcast. So I you know, it was all sort of thrown together at the last minute, but it's been enjoyable.
Oh yeah, I know my shit, man. The S doesn't just stand for serious. It doesn't just stand for Scott. It stands for spiteful. Despiteful, terribly vindictive drama podcast. Or dick. Anyway, all right. On that note, Brian, thank you so much for, me basically recruiting you just an hour or two before we actually recorded. And thank you to myself for actually deciding to do this. So.
Well, it was enjoyable. And let me end with a reference. Let me say that since I'm the last in line saying goodbye, that I encourage all you rock and roll children to stand up and shout. Long live Dio, long live Eddie. Thanks for listening.